Welcome to the Wise Women Diaries podcast. This is where shame and victimhood die. I am a woman that questions everything, so this podcast is a reflection of that. Here, we speak on non-mainstream perspectives, like how children are the biggest teachers, how to turn pain to wisdom, and the journey of learning to trust ourselves. We discuss what it looks like to own our power as a woman and question the medical paradigm. That's why I am obsessed with interviewing women who trust their bodies and babies in home birth and free birth. Ultimately, this podcast is for women who question the status quo, but are dedicated to thriving and learning how to take radical responsibility for their life and shed victimhood for good.
Hey everyone, my name is Natalie. I am a stay-at-home mother of two. I have a two and a half year old daughter and a 8 month old son. I really enjoy gardening and spending time with my family and being outdoors. I'm a transplant from Chicago to South Carolina. I've lived a pretty interesting life. I've lived in Illinois, Pennsylvania, Florida, where I lived in Orlando and worked at Disney. I lived in downtown Seattle and worked at the original Starbucks. And from Seattle, I moved with my ex-husband to Oahu, Hawaii, where I actually got divorced and met my current husband and the father of my children. We have a dog, a cat, and three chickens in the backyard, and life is pretty good. We decided, actually, my husband got out of the military in the beginning of 2020, which was a wild time for a career transfer. We were kind of just winging it and trying to make the transition work when the world shut down, and we decided that we were going to try to expand our family. We went into it thinking, yeah, you know, this will probably take a while. A lot of my girlfriends have tried for, you know, 4 or 5 months, 8, 9 months, a year plus. So we went into it thinking we had some time. And I actually, by some chance, got pregnant the very first cycle that we tried. I knew absolutely nothing about like natural family planning and tracking my cycle on my own. I just kind of relied on the Ovia app, like I feel most women do. So I didn't have a lot of faith in it that it would happen. And then a month later, my period wasn't there, which was a huge shock. We didn't think that that was going to happen like that. And with my pregnancy, we kind of just coasted along. I have a history of thyroid issues, so my OB referred me to an MFM doctor to be monitored for that. So when we went to my anatomy scan, I had actually mentioned to the technician that I had a weird sort of like pressure feeling in my pelvis that I had just kind of chalked up to normal pregnancy feelings. And the tech actually, she kind of got concerned and asked if she could do a transvaginal ultrasound instead of an abdominal one over my stomach. And she went in and she checked my cervix and we could see that it was funneling where it was opening from the uterine wall side, which at 20 weeks it should not be doing. And from there, we continued to monitor my cervix. And then a week later, I had went in and my cervix was measuring about 2.6 centimeters. The average cervical length for a like 20-ish week pregnancy is about 4 to 5 centimeters, and anything below a 2.5 would qualify you for a cervical cerclage. So we were just going to continue to monitor. I was taking a vaginal progesterone suppository, and progesterone is one of the hormones that helps maintain your cervical stability. So we thought we were going to be okay, and about 2 days later, that was on a Monday, Wednesday morning, I had woke up, and the pressure that I was feeling felt different. So I called my MFM, maternal fetal medicine doctor, and they wanted me to come in that morning for another scan. And when I went in, my cervix was funneling again, and it measured 1.3. So I had lost half of my cervical length in less than 48 hours. And they took me that day to the hospital to do the procedure. Quick procedure. Like literally takes 5 minutes. You do have to have a spinal for it, which I'm thankful for because I could not imagine what it would feel like to have stitches in your cervix. So definitely thankful for that. And now I'll go back into the induction story. So at 37 and 5, I went in to be induced. We stopped at Five Guys on the way in because I wanted French fries. And I didn't know the things that I know now, where hospital policy is not law and you can eat while you're in labor. Because when you think about it, if somebody has an emergency and they go to the ER and have to require surgery, they don't know if you haven't eaten in hours. So it's kind of just one of those things where it's the system trying to, I feel like, take advantage of women. And if you don't know, then you don't know. We got super, super lucky. I mean, I got super lucky. Knowing the things that I know now and having a lot of friends who are birth workers, when I share my induction story, are just baffled at how many things could have gone wrong but didn't. I went in and my cervix was super firm and closed, so there was no dilation, no effacement. They decided to do 3 rounds of a oral cervical ripener called Cytotec, and you take those every 4 hours. So I started at 8 p.m. I had another pill at around midnight, and I had another pill around 4 a.m. They came in, I think it was around 7:30-ish, to do a cervical exam to see if I needed more. My cervix was dilated to about a 2 and about 60% effaced. The doctor from my practice decided that they were going to break my water, which at a 2 is absolutely astounding and should never, ever be done. Typically, once you're in the hospital and your water's broken, it's a ticking time bomb to a, quote, emergency cesarean. And most hospitals will only allow you to be in active labor, or not even active labor, to allow you to be... Most hospitals will only allow you to have ruptured membranes for about 24 hours before they require cesarean. So they broke my water at about a 2, and I immediately went into active labor. I have never felt anything like that in my life. I thought I was dying. I could not get comfortable. I immediately asked for an epidural. I ended up drinking all the apple juice that the labor and delivery floor had, because that was, I guess, keeping me happy. The anesthesiologist and his team finally got into the room about an hour and a half later. So this was around 9 o'clock-ish, and placed my epidural. I was in so much pain that I was lucky that I was even able to get from the bed and the floor where I was kneeling over the edge into the bed for placement. And after my epidural was placed, they did another cervical check, and I was measuring about 100% effacement and about 7 centimeters, which I didn't know then, but I do know now that once you hit about a 7 and you have that sensation of, oh my God, I can't do this anymore, generally that's when you've hit the transition point in labor, which should be the fastest point in labor. So I was very thankful at the time that I got the epidural. I had asked for oxygen from the nurse because I felt like I was having trouble breathing, but my O2 levels looked good. But my blood pressure ended up tanking from the epidural, which is a very common side effect. I can't remember if anesthesia told us that that was something that could happen or not. I'm sure they did. But this was, at this point, almost 3 years ago. And they came back in and they gave me oxygen, and I just kind of wrote it out in my bed. And the nurse told me that if I felt like there was a bowling ball in my pelvis, that meant it was time to push. So I had that sensation, called the nurse, she came in, the baby was crowning, and the nurse's reaction was, oh my God, she has so much hair, it's literally hanging out of you. Which to me is hilarious looking back on now, because my daughter's hair is absolutely insane. It is past her butt crack and thicker than mine. I'm sure if we shaved off both of our hair, that by way she would have more hair than me. So just crazy revelation. And she was born pretty rapidly after that. My total time from when they broke my water to her being born was, I think it was 4.5 hours, like minutes shy of 4.5 hours. And the craziest part about that is I did not have Pitocin. So I got induced with just Cytotec. They popped my water at a 2, which is playing with fire. And from that moment, she was still born in 4.5 hours, even with an epidural. So like when they gave me my epidural, she still took 3 hours after that, which should have been the fastest point of labor. So I knew going forward that if we ever had more children, that it would probably be quick, because I feel like that's unheard of for a first-time mom to not only not have Pitocin, but to be induced and have a baby that quick. I did tear twice with her. I had 2 second-degree tears. And knowing what I know now, I personally chalk that up to my epidural and coached pushing. Coached pushing is when you have an epidural and you are laying on your back in the hospital and the doctor is reading the contraction monitor and tells you when to push. Because you don't really feel the surges and the sensations, so crazy. But I'm just thankful that she's good. It's funny, too, that I trusted the system so much with her, because COVID kind of brought a lot of light for me and my family, well, me and my husband at the time. So I went in trusting the doctors and knew, like, okay, I'm going to listen to them, but we're going to delay vaccine. Okay, I'm going to breastfeed. All right, I'm going to cloth diaper. So just kind of, like, funny that there was so much trust, but also there was still that uncertainty and distrust in the system. I did end up vaccinating her a little bit at 2 months and a little bit at 4 months, and then my husband finally got on board, and we no longer vaccinate our children. I personally feel like the risk is not worth the benefit, and that's a choice that we've made for our own family. At around 2.5 months, we determined that my daughter was super colicky and had a dairy allergy. I didn't know, but I knew in my gut that there was something wrong, like something was not okay. Like, no baby should cry like that. We reached points where we would sit and cry together because she was just so inconsolable. And we just kind of did everything like normal people would do with her. You know, I had her in the hospital and, oh, we're going to put her in this like little Velcro swaddle and hopefully she'll sleep better. And, you know, it'll it'll help with their Moro reflex, which is the startle reflex, which should help keep them asleep longer. And I insisted on following the ABCs of safe sleep, which I think now, like, safe sleep groups are just nightmares for new parents because they are really, really mean and really nasty people. But I insisted that I would never bed share, I would never co-sleep because it wasn't safe, and how can people do that to their children? And she hated the bassinet, hated it. We tried everything. I wore the bassinet sheets in my shirt to try to make them smell like me. We skipped the warm water bottle trick, and I would put the heating pad in there so that it was warm. We tried, like, the baby nighttime spray. And she hated it. I got to a point where I was so sleep deprived with her that I ended up falling asleep in unsafe places. So we would fall asleep nursing on the couch. We would fall asleep nursing in the rocker. You can co-sleep safely, but falling asleep in situations like that is not safe. Like, the baby can fall. You can suffocate your baby. And one day we were taking a nap together. Well, we weren't taking a nap together. We ended up taking a nap together. We were side-laying nursing in the bed and ended up falling asleep, and she actually slept. And that's the moment where I realized that bed sharing picked me. I decided from that moment on, okay, she's sleeping, I'm sleeping, let's do some research and find out how we can do this safely. So did some research, followed a couple people on Instagram, found out about the Safe Sleep 7, which is kind of like a little rule guide to safely bed sharing. People call it co-sleeping, but the correct term for co-sleeping is just sharing a room with your infant. When you are physically in bed together, that's technically bed sharing. So we follow Safe Sleep 7, And it was a turning point. Things were still really difficult for me, but we made it through because I was getting at least a hair more sleep. And then once we had found out about her dairy allergy and with how passionate I was about wanting to be successful breastfeeding, I did go dairy free to accommodate her allergy, which wasn't easy. And dairy free vegan cheese is gross. Like, I'm sorry, you cannot imitate real cheese. And that was another thing that kind of got me to where I am today, was reading labels on food to check for dairy. I'm reading labels at the grocery store and I'm like, what the heck is this stuff in my food? Like, why is there dairy in this potato chip? What? Like, none of this makes sense. And that kind of helped my little evolution into who I am today. And, you know, I'm more conscious of certain things that we do as a family, and the things that we put into our bodies. But now she's a very healthy, happy 2.5-year-old with a awesome little brother. Her name's Penny and his name is Forrest. We call him Forrest Dude. And whenever my daughter talks to people on the phone or in general, she's like, my mommy, my daddy, and Forrest Dude. So it's really cute to hear her kind of mimic what we call him.
That's so cute. And those names are adorable. Wow. I want to know, thank you so much for talking about your sleeping evolution, because I think a lot of women can and will relate to that. I am curious as to when your mind started opening and being blown about the medical industry with birth.
I would say probably closer to like when my daughter was about a year old. Since we were newer, well, I was newer in South Carolina, and my husband kind of stinks at keeping up with people, even though he lived here his whole life. I met a really great woman on a local, I think he was a local Facebook group, not even our local holistic, like crunchy parenting group, just a normal mom's group, I think. And she invited me to a mom's brunch. Her and I had hit it off really well, but all of the people that attend the brunch are usually like more crunchy, like-minded families. Most of them had had home births or had a hospital birth, and then their sequential pregnancies had home births. So I think it was once I kind of surrounded myself with those people, I kind of felt like the outcast at first, because I'm like, wow, all these people had their babies at home and there's me. Oh yeah, my baby was born in the hospital. Woo. And, you know, I have a friend who's a birth worker. I have lots of friends who are birth workers, but one of my dear friends does birth photography, and her and I are very close. And just hearing experiences from her and like the other moms and, you know, getting to know other birth workers really kind of made me start to think. And I was like, you know what? Next time I get pregnant, I want something different for myself. I don't really like how my birth went, even though it was the best possible outcome for an induction, even considering just induction alone. But the way I was induced and what had happened, like, that could not have gone any better for, I think, any human. So I knew probably around when she was like 1 year old that I wanted to have a home birth the next time we had a baby. It took forever to get my husband on board, and my birth worker friends and the midwife that I ended up choosing both kind of were all like, oh yeah, you know, like, that's his job as dad. That's his job as the protector, because this is what he knows. He knows that that's safe, and, you know, like, this is kind of uncertain, but that's also, I think, because of how the industrial medical complex has made birth into a emergency, versus allowing women to do what we were made to do. And that might sound ignorant to some people, but the more that I've learned and the more that I've developed as my own person, I think that women are a lot more capable of things than we believe we are. And yeah, so we decided to have a baby. again. And we went into it thinking, oh yeah, we're not going to get this lucky again. Like, Penny only took one cycle. It's not going to happen again. It can't happen again. It'll probably take a few months. And then this time around, I got my period back while I was still breastfeeding at around 14 months. And I think when we started trying, it was, I think I was like in my 15th month postpartum. And I was practicing natural family planning. I knew how to read my cervical mucus and actively tracked ovulation that way. And we got pregnant the first time again, which I feel like is super unheard of. So we decided that if we are ever going to have another third child or more, that we have to be ready when we decide to try. And then, of course, that time it'll take forever. But I'd rather be safe than sorry. And I knew that I wanted to have a midwife. So I interviewed some midwives, and there was two that I felt would work for me based off of my situation with my cervix. I didn't want to take a risk of not having a cervical cerclage done in my pregnancy and run the risk of potentially losing my baby. Whether or not I do have true IC or not, it wasn't something that I think I would be able to live with had I not had that intervention done. Because in the back of my mind, I feel like, oh, if I didn't get it done and I lost the baby, like, how would I ever forgive myself when I know I could have had something done that could have prevented that? So based off of that, the hospital group midwives would not take me. They told me that I was too high risk. There was another midwife who used to work with the hospital group who owns her own birth center and home birth facility, home birth practice. And she also told me that I was too high risk. So I was kind of starting to get limited in my resources. I reached out to two midwives, and my biggest qualm with going into having a home birth this time was that it was going to be quick. There was nothing that I knew more certainly than that this baby was going to come quick, and I wanted a midwife that made me feel confident and knowledgeable with my body and birth. Because my biggest concern was, okay, well, what if my midwife's not there? What if she doesn't make it? What if it's so fast? And when I was interviewing both midwives, one of the midwives, who's a great midwife and she's hilarious, but when I had told her that, she was like, oh, you know, I don't really support free birth. I want to be there in case something goes wrong. So, you know, like, that's not really my cup of tea. And I'm thinking in my head, okay, well, obviously, like, I want a professional there, but if they don't make it, like, I want to know that I've got this, I can do this, my midwife is on her way and will be here. And the second midwife that I had interviewed was like, oh yeah, my third baby was a free birth. And I just thought to myself the whole time, oh yeah, where's the midwife? Oh yeah, it's me. Not necessarily that alone, her overall demeanor, but just the confidence that she gave me in myself was like, okay, this is the midwife for me. So, whole pregnancy, I went through it thinking, okay, the baby's going to be quick, but we're not going to, you know, make it past my due date with my cervix. Once they clip my cerclage, he's probably going to come. There's no way my cervix is going to hold up. And my midwife jokingly was like, what if you make it to 40 weeks? And I'm like, I'm not going to make it to my due date. What if he comes on my birthday? My birthday is July 11th, and my due date with my son was July 15th, and I'm like, go figure. Like, that would be my luck. He's going to come on my birthday. Well, July 11th came and went. The baby was not here. July 15th came and went, and the baby was not here. My midwife's like, oh, you made it to your due date. I'm like, yeah, I did. Crazy, because I never thought that that would happen. And not even that, but I went into labor at 41 and 1. So I went, like, way past my due date. It was crazy. Like, I had 13 hours of prodromal labor the night before. I had my midwife come with my birth team. Just knowing my history, I wanted to be checked, and I didn't know that it was prodromal labor until after I got checked. Prodromal labor is when you have consistent timable contractions, but there is no changes to your cervix. So my midwife came, and I was like, please check me, because if I really progressed, like, I might toy with the process. And with a home birth, it would be something like herbs, or if you're really feeling risky, a castor oil or like a midwife's brew, which is like a castor oil smoothie, or your midwife can pop your water for you, and it's totally like up to mom. Like, it's mom's choice at that point. And when they took my cerclage out at like 36 and some weeks, my cervix was a solid maybe 1 centimeter open. And after those 13 hours of prodromal labor, my midwife checked me and she's like, "You're still a one." And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, I felt so defeated. I cried. I was supported by my doula and my photographer, and my midwife and my husband. And I decided to rest and relax. They all left and I took a very long nap. I woke up and went to Target for a new heating pad because I couldn't find my heating pad. Came home, had Taco Bell for dinner, totally the not crunchiest thing ever, and went to bed. I woke up close to midnight in full-blown active labor. I felt like an inchworm. My body, I just could not get comfortable. And it was so intense. I almost forgot what it was like. I started timing my contractions and they went from 12 minutes to, I think it was like 12 minutes, 11 minutes, 8, 5, 3, 3, 3. And I was on the phone with my doula and she was like, "Hey, you know, time your contractions for me." And then I had timed them for her. And I reached a point where I was like, "I don't think I can do this. Like, I feel like I'm going to pass out." And she's like, "I'm on my way." So she decided that she was going to be on her way. I woke my husband up at that point. I went from laboring in the living room to laboring on the dilation station, as they call it, which is the toilet. I was straddling the toilet facing the wall. That was the only place that was moderately comfortable for me. And I woke my husband up, told him to call the midwife. This was probably around like 1 o'clock. And he's like, "Well, what do you want me to say?" And I'm like, "I don't know. Just call Janelle and tell her she needs to come." And he's like, "Well, she's going to ask me." And I'm like, "Well, then tell her to call Taylor, my doula." And he called. And of course, she asked some questions that he didn't know how to answer. And I couldn't really articulate. My doula got there. And the bathroom that I was laboring in was our hall bathroom, which it's a full bath, but it's pretty small. And she's like, "Do you want to get on all fours in here?" And I said, "Absolutely not. Put the nugget at the end of the hall." And the nugget is my daughter's play couch. And so she ran out there and moved the nugget and put the wimpiest Chucks pads ever down. Only a few of them. I could barely walk. My husband had to, like, fireman assist carry me from the bathroom to the end of the hall. And I started to labor on the nugget. Thought I was going to pass out. My doula's like, "Here, take my Stanley and drink this LMNT, and here's a honey stick," and like shoved it in my mouth. I felt like I was in outer space. It was the most intense thing I've ever experienced. But I knew this time. I knew that once I felt that sensation of, "Oh my God, I can't do this anymore," that he was going to be here. And there was a point where I was like, "Oh my gosh, I think I have to poop." And my doula goes, "Let me get the flashlight." And she's like, "Oh, that's ahead." And I was like, "All right, it's game time." Meanwhile, my husband has no clue what's going on. And after the baby was born and we were all sitting down around the couch, like talking, it was really interesting to hear his perspective on all of that. But I think he came out in two pushes. My birth photographer got to the house. As he was crowning, she literally opened the door and his head was there. Which has been her biggest fear since she became a birth photographer, was missing the baby being born. And my midwife did not make it. She showed up to the party about 5 to 10 minutes after the baby was born. So my instinct was right the whole time that my midwife probably wasn't going to make it. So I had home birth termed free birth, which is pretty cool and definitely the most empowering thing that I have ever done, because to live in a society where you're told you can't, this isn't safe, your body's not meant to do this. Yes, they are. Like, if you just sit and you listen to your body, the experience is so different. Like, my whole my whole labor and delivery was just incredible the second time around because of what I knew, what I learned about our bodies and the whole process of labor and delivery. And there is no feeling greater than catching your own child. Like, I stood, like, kneeled there on the nugget, touched his head, and, like, grabbed him out. Like, it was the coolest thing I've ever done. And what's funny is when he was, like, crowning and coming out, the first thing I said was, oh my god, he has so much hair, just like Penny. Because the whole time I was pregnant, I was like, yeah, you know, like, me and Nate, we both had a lot of hair when we were babies. Penny had the most insane amount of hair we've ever seen, that anybody's ever seen. There's no way he's going to have as much hair. And he did. So I think, you know, now at 8 months, he's already had, like, 4 or 5 haircuts at home. So, yeah, it's crazy. And it was just such a transformative experience to know that I did it. I did the most natural and empowering thing that women can do. And to know that society thinks that we can't do it is just astounding to me, because it was so incredible. I don't have any other words for it. And the afterbirth high that I felt after my son was like 2 weeks long. I rode that wave for as long as I could ride it. I was like, yeah, I did the thing. I feel great. I'm on top of the world. I don't even think I had baby blues the second time around. And with my daughter, like, don't get me wrong, she was my firstborn, and it was so exhilarating to, you know, see her and, you know, to get to have that. But I think just everything that was done so differently this time around made it that much more enjoyable. And I also set myself up for postpartum the second time around. I feel like society pushes, like, oh, we're going to have a baby shower and we're going to take care of the baby. And no, like, what about mom? Like, mom needs to be taken care of. The baby's going to get taken care of regardless, but who's going to take care of mom? We don't have the village mindset anymore. And even the support that you do get if you have friends and family nearby is not really what it used to be. And I'm very thankful that I have the friends that I have, because if anything crazy happens, there's someone so quick to set up a meal train or help out, and they come to see the baby and you, and they're like, oh, let me run your vacuum, let me do your dishes.
Yeah, can you specifically talk about your first postpartum compared to your second? Because it is quite classic where a first-time mom focuses so much on the baby clothes and the nursery. And that's one of my first posts that went pretty big on Trusting Birth's account, where it was something like, we need to focus on postpartum, not the freaking nursery and the baby clothes.
So different the second time around with postpartum. With my first, my mom, who I no longer speak to, came and she stayed with us for a week to help. And then my mother-in-law came and stayed for a week to help. But that was the extent of the help that we had. And they were both great for what it was. They helped around the house. They made sure I was showering. They made sure that, you know, like, if I needed a break from the baby, that I could take a nap and they would take care of the baby. But that also involved me pumping to make sure that someone was able to feed the baby. And my daughter didn't take passies. But aside from that, like, I had nothing really postpartum. Like, I had, like, a good postpartum kit that I put together to take care of myself. But it just felt very lonely. And I think that's also because I didn't really have friends. I definitely didn't have mom friends here. I had all my friends from where I've lived throughout the country online for support. But there's something so different about having physical support right near you. And, you know, this time around, I had my son, and even though I felt really great, I still had a lot of physical support. My friends set up a meal train for me. I had dinners and breakfasts, you know, brought over to me for, you know, on and off for probably about like 2 weeks, which is such a huge help, especially because I was very lazy and did not freezer prep a lot of, like, freezer meals. But we still managed, and just having that assistance or people that would come and pick up my daughter and take her for a few hours so that I could sleep with the baby and not have to worry about my toddler getting into something that she wasn't supposed to get into.
Yeah, I'm so happy you're speaking to this because you are talking about in-person community, and the internet is amazing and social media is amazing because we can find internet friends, and that's good. But in postpartum, you're speaking to having community from your first postpartum. You had some help from mothers and in-laws, but the second postpartum, you had community, and I would say that is the most powerful difference, and I'm happy you're speaking to it because in this digital era, people can tend to think that internet friends are enough, and it's not true. It's not true.
No, it's great when you need somebody to like talk to and to vent to, but it's not the same as having somebody come over and like physically help you. It's also really funny to look back and reminisce because I was so focused on my daughter, my first pregnancy, and I think part of it might have been to kind of like take away and alleviate some of the anxieties that I had about my cervix or like her coming early and being a micro preemie or like something crazy like that. But she had a nursery, it was painted, all of her clothes were hung up and organized and washed and like everything that you could think of. We did virtual baby shower because it was COVID. And with my son, I didn't announce my pregnancy, period. I was like, I'm going to keep this private. I want to enjoy it for what it is. I don't want to be harassed all the time. I don't want to be bothered. I don't want people to be like, oh, you're having another baby. No, I just want to be left alone. Like, I was working full-time remote with my toddler home with no help. We bought a house in January of 2023. We just finished setting up the room for my daughter like a couple months ago. I had no intentions of setting up a nursery this time. I had no desire to like do all of these crazy things. I didn't care about having a baby sprinkle or anything like that. It was just more important for me to know that I had my head on straight and that I was gonna be able to like get through it this time. And it's also crazy to think about too, because knowing where I am right now in this moment, I do think that I had some sort of postpartum mood disorder after I had my daughter. Her first year of life was probably the hardest year I have ever experienced. It was very taxing for me as a mom, as a working mom. It was very trying for my marriage, the transition. I'm very thankful to have such an understanding and supportive husband because it's a miracle, honestly, that we're still married. And I didn't want to admit to myself that, like, I had those things. And with my son, obviously, like, I'm not a huge fan of big pharma. I don't want a lot of unnecessary interventions. I don't like taking medication. We've really transitioned to a more holistic lifestyle. And I think that speaks for a lot about who I am as a person. I've come off mood stabilizers while I was pregnant with my daughter, and the only prescription medication that I take now is for my thyroid because I had a procedure done on that, and I have to take a thyroid supplement, and I'm not quite ballsy enough to take desiccated thyroid and like go down that path all over again because that was really hard. But about a month ago, maybe a month, month and a half ago, I started toying with the idea of there has got to be something going on. Like, this is not what motherhood is. And I admitted to myself that I think my postpartum rage that I've experienced, where I'm just very short-fused, short-tempered, and always angry all the time, isn't just because of lack of sleep, isn't just because of lack of nutrition or, you know, breastfeeding depleting me. I do think that this time around, I too suffered from some sort, I am suffering from some sort of postpartum mood disorder. And I actually reached out to my midwife about 3.5 weeks ago and was like, hey, please put in a script of Lexapro for me. And it was at the point where I realized, yeah, I don't really want to do this. I don't really want to take a medication, but the things that I'm doing right now are not working and I need to do this. Like, I need to do this for myself, for my husband, and for my children, because I am not being the best me, the best mom, and the best wife that I can be. And this is only short term. So it's like to see how I've kind of developed in that aspect where it's like, oh yeah, the first time around, I just kind of suffered in silence and made it work. And this time I'm like, you know what? Like, I don't really like this stuff. It's only temporary. This is a season. It will pass. Things will get better. Things will change. My hormones will level out again and like it will get better. So like for now, this is working for us. And the amount of difference that I've felt in just the few like short weeks that I've been taking it has been, it's been crazy to think that I don't yell at my toddler as much. I don't get quite as overstimulated while nursing with the baby. And overall, I feel like my demeanor has really kind of changed and I feel more like myself again. You know, been able to have the strength and the will to admit to myself that like I needed more help this time. And being able to take that, I feel like speaks volumes about who I am as a person and the things that I value.
Everyone's journey is so entirely different that there's some people where they reach a point and their medicine is getting off of medicine. And then for some people, their medicine is taking medicine. And you can only speak to it to a personal, unique journey. To me, it's same with prayer. I don't know if you're spiritual or not, but it's some people pray and pray and pray for change. And it's like, dude, you got to take some action. And then there's other people who are doing action, action, action. They're trying to do all this action and they actually just have to surrender and pray and give it to a higher power. And there can never be a one size fits all because we're all literally on our own journeys.
No, and it's interesting that you say that too, because it's kind of like you just kind of fall to the pressures. I actually, I don't know if it was prop at this point of my life, I don't know if it was properly diagnosed or if it was, you know, something else. But I was on 2 different mood stabilizers for bipolar 2 disorder and I was taking high dosage Klonopin and I knew that I didn't like taking it. So I stopped taking it and actually my mood has been a lot better since then. And I self-medicate through other means for my anxiety that seems to really work. But man, postpartum is is something else. And I feel like we don't talk about it enough and people don't really know what it's like. I love the influencer. Her name's Libby. I think it's Libby. She's Diary of an Honest Mom, where she talks about like her feelings and emotions and like things as a mom that I feel like most of society would think is kind of taboo. But she's like, yeah, I feel like this. And like, I sometimes think about like, what if I drove my car off a cliff and like things like that. And I feel like the more that we talk about that, the more that it's going to be normalized for women to accept that like what you're feeling is normal. Like you're not crazy. It's just there. But the more we talk about it, the more we know about it and you feel less alone when there's more people.
Yeah, secret is a secret because we tell no one. So simply sharing these dark thoughts or feelings with a trusted friend or spouse is what liberates a secret from being a secret. And keeping it inside, keeping it a secret is what makes it feel dark and heavy. And it's literally the liberation of sharing to another trusted person. That is freedom in some sense. I also want to tell people, if they resonate with this aspect of your story, that I have a beautiful conversation with my dear friend Cynthia from last summer. I think her podcast, on this podcast, it's titled like Motherhood Postpartum Awakening or something, because she was also diagnosed with bipolar and then she ended up in a psych ward in her postpartum. And her story details that that was her underworld experience from maiden to mother. And it changed her whole life to, for the better, because she found Dr. Kelly Brogan, who was a psychiatrist. I don't know if you know Dr. Kelly Brogan. She was a psychiatrist who gave, you know, these meds to pregnant women and mothers. And then she actually read the literature on these meds. And then she started a practice to getting people off these meds. And so my friend Cynthia, this is her whole journey. It's who she is because of her postpartum and her time in the psych ward with a newborn. And she couldn't be with her newborn. But I would suggest that story on my podcast. It's really special. And it's the first time she ever shared that story because she held a lot of shame with it, right? There's a lot of shame with these stories.
Yeah, I feel like it's so stigmatized that like people feel like they can't talk about it without being judged. But it's so powerful to actually speak and share your story. And there's a lot of things that I've gone through in my life where I feel like if I can just be open and vulnerable and share my story and it helps one person, then that vulnerability and opening myself up like that was worth it to help just one singular person. So I definitely have always been very, I've been very open about most things that I've gone through. I was open about my mental health when I was younger. I was open about my divorce. I've been very outwardly spoken about cutting ties with my mother. And I've been very, very open about my pregnancy journey and my story with home birth, to the point where I've had people that I haven't spoken to in years that just follow me on Instagram. And I garbage post a lot in my stories on Instagram. But I've had at least three or four people, maybe pushing five, who have reached out to me and asked questions and felt inspired and compelled to have a home birth with their first or their second child. I've had people who have reached out to me, hey, I just found out I'm pregnant. I haven't even announced it yet. Can I ask you some questions? And it's so amazing to know that just by sharing my story and sharing things and content that I believe in has created visibility to people who may not have seen it otherwise. And it gets the gears rolling. It gets everything starting to tick and people to question and, hey, how was this experience different from that? Oh, you know, like, what did you enjoy about this versus that? And being able to share my story and, you know, help what I feel like is empowering other women to do great things is really, really beautiful to know that I'm a safe space for people to ask questions about without having sort of exposed themselves to the general public yet. And without trying to be egotistical, like it's really nice and it's a really great feeling for people to come to you and ask you for things and your opinion because they feel like they can trust what you're saying. And I think that's been the best part to me about sharing my journey with my son was that it's kind of just like it's helped other women. My friend is pregnant with her second and she's due on May 4th. And she was so inspired by my story. And I shared with her that I was pregnant without like announcing, but she knew. And she was just so inspired by how different my care was with my home birth midwife that she's having a home birth. And, you know, it's really cool to see other women develop like that and be like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. Like I'm, you know, like my midwife is awesome. And, you know, even down to I've had her and another friend asked me to help them like pick a midwife or like, hey, this is this midwife's website. Can you check it out and let me know what you think? Oh, what kind of questions should I ask my midwife? And I'm like, I got you. I got you. Let's do this.
Is there anything else that you would want to touch on to wrap up? Anything about your mothering journey, maiden to mother, breastfeeding?
I could talk about breastfeeding. I'm very, very passionate about that. And we had a lot of troubles with my daughter that I kind of persisted through. And then with my son, it's been a cakewalk because I know more now. And I've actually my friend that's due, I think, next month, another friend that's due next month having a home birth, actually just messaged me this weekend and was like, hey, can you compile some data and information and, like, stuff for me about breastfeeding because I know nothing. And I'm like, yeah, let me help you out. And my best friend, actually, her son was born 5 days after Forrest. They had tons of issues, and I was her support. I mean, her husband was her support too, but I was the support she needed to persist, and they are still exclusively nursing. So it's really cool. With my daughter, I knew that I wanted to breastfeed. I didn't want to formula feed because have you looked at formula ingredients? but also, like, I wanted that bond with her, and I wanted things with her to be special. And we went through the dairy allergy where I cut dairy for her, which was a huge sacrifice for me because I am a grazer and I snack a lot throughout the day and I eat a lot of cheese. I eat a lot of yogurt and things like that. I drink a latte every morning, and I know now that almond milk and oat milk are not great for you. So, you know, that was a very interesting point of my life where I had to drink almond or oat milk, and I made it at home so that it was better and cheaper to be able to provide that nutrients for her. And then after that, we battled some supply issues where she was having trouble gaining weight. And on top of, you know, struggling to gain weight because her body was attacking itself from the casein proteins from milk that were getting passed through my breast milk, to me having a thyroid issue, which a lot of women postpartum, even if you don't have pre-existing thyroid issues, you can develop them postpartum, and your thyroid can really affect your ability to produce breast milk. So I feel like when women typically have issues breastfeeding, and it's a supply issue, I say that very loosely, that professionals aren't really quick to jump to want to test their thyroid when it really could be what the issue is. So I saw lactation, and the lactation at the peds office was garbage. She was like, oh, you know, like, latch her on both sides. We did some weighted feeds. Oh, do you want to go home with formula just in case? First of all, that's not support. That is not how you support a breastfeeding mother. You don't, oh, just in case, because you're giving them that fear that they already have in themselves, and you're making them doubt their capabilities. So I saw lactation at the hospital where my daughter was born, and we worked really, really hard. And she, you know, I gave her my medical history. She was able to see it in my chart anyways. We decided to have my thyroid tested. I was working on adequately hydrating my body because hydration is a huge thing for breastfeeding as well. And my thyroid levels were slightly off. And once we adjusted my medication and I started to level out again, I had no issues with my breast milk supply anymore. So it's just the perseverance that I had to be successful was really kind of powerful to me, because I feel like everybody always talks about, like, oh yeah, mom's mental health matters. Well, yeah, mom's mental health does matter, but what matters more? Mom feeling guilty that she had to quit or that she wasn't enough? Or mom's guilt that for a short period of time, she thinks that she's, like, starving her child to be successful. Like, for me personally, the feeling of, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I let that happen for a month and a half, but we nursed until she was 23 months, like, I made it, versus, oh, we were only able to breastfeed for 6 weeks because my breast milk wasn't enough. I feel like this might sound attacking and, like, triggering for some women, but I think it's because of the lack of adequate support that we have for nursing moms. And it also kind of ties into my own personal beliefs on, you know, big pharma. You know, they are the ones that make formula, and they're the ones that are making money off of it. So it's like, they're not going to make money off of a mom who successfully breastfeeds. And I'm just going to share this, like, little tidbit about my best friend. I'm not going to name her or anything, but her son was born 5 days after mine, and for weeks and weeks, she was in pain and miserable. Her nipples were chapped and cracked and bleeding, and she went through, I think it was 3 different lactation consultants who all told her, oh, no, your baby doesn't have ties. The pain will go away. It'll stop. And I feel like in most cases, most women would be like, okay, like, I'm done. And I won't lie, like, she did have those thoughts. And there was a point where her husband offered to, like, go and get formula, like, just in case, even though he was really supportive of her. But the whole time, I was there for her in her corner, like, rooting. I was like, oh, have you thought about, like, myofascial therapy to have them assessed for oral function? Have you thought about bringing the baby to the chiro? Like, what about a pediatric dentist? Like, have you done these things to have other opinions? Because this is not normal. Like, this is not how breastfeeding should be. Yeah, the first week or two is kind of hard and, like, it stinks. But, like, no, you need real support. Like, I'm not going to sit here and be like, oh, well, like, you should just go and pick it up just in case. And now her son is 8 months old and she's still exclusively nursing. And it's just, I mean, this definitely is sounds super big-headed, but, like, it's really cool to know that, like, I helped her make it to her goals. I've always been really passionate about lactation, and I've considered going down one of the pathways to become an IBCLC, which is a board-certified lactation consultant, but it's just not in the finances for us right now, which is a shame, but I still definitely offer her to help my friends and even, like, people online if they have questions and things, like, that I know the answer to or, like, can offer some sort of help or assistance to. Like, I'm more than happy because I feel like if a woman wants to breastfeed, she should be able to breastfeed.
I love that you brought that story up because what if she didn't have support, right? What if she had only the voices in the room said, it's okay, you can give up. It's okay. It's okay, you can give up. What would it, how would that have panned out? You know, long term, everyone's journey is so different, but giving up because you don't have support is a very common thing in our society because people don't support breastfeeding. They say fed is best. But long term, we all go through challenges and most breastfeeding women go through a hiccup with breastfeeding or a few hiccups. That's pretty common. What if she just gave up? She didn't have the support of you and she would have this like nagging guilt forever. Like, oh, I gave up too soon. I feel like this could be received in a very way, but just think about the long-term impact of giving up too fast. And I don't blame women for giving up too fast, but it's because we don't have community of support that are in alignment with our values, values of breastfeeding. It's not just about the food. It's about the bond. It's about the mother's body making the pharmacy of the milk hourly, daily for the baby.
Mom's mental health, like that's kind of where my big thing is. Like I said before, everybody's like, oh, well, mom's mental health matters. Yeah, the guilt for me personally of thinking that I starved my baby for like a couple weeks is a lot less than the lifelong guilt of feeling like I quit too soon or that I gave up and that I'm a failure. And I think it boils down to, you know, the community and having adequate support. You know, adequate support when nursing or breastfeeding, because pumping is also breastfeeding. You know, any form of breast milk to a baby is breastfeeding. And to just go to the pediatrician or have your mom in your ear because you were formula fed, because all us kids in the 90s, not all of us, but, you know, like the vast majority of us were formula fed and, you know, all these things. And you know, you have your family or your spouse and the doctors and all these other people like, oh, it's okay, you can stop. Like, oh, it's hard, just stop and here's some formula, it'll be easier. I feel like that's not really support. Like, if you know what mom's goal is and you know that mom wants to breastfeed, help her figure out what is wrong. Help her, you know, troubleshoot and go through any sort of necessary steps to kind of remedy the issue. Because having a truly low supply is very, very rare. And it's typically either most women who have a low supply, like genuinely have a low supply, it's because they have a lack of glandular tissue, which is the tissue in your breast that produce the milk. And that's not super common. And things like hind milk, fore milk imbalance is also rather rare. So it's just like, you know, you see these things that are being pushed by pediatricians and even lactation consultants, which is mind-blowing to me that we have lactation professionals who are not giving adequate lactation support to these breastfeeding moms. Just like, all I can really do is shake my head about it because it's sad. It's sad that women don't have proper support to reach their goals. And I feel like if we had more of a community of women who were willing and ready to help mom reach her goals, that there would be a lot more women who were successful with breastfeeding. And I genuinely feel like, you know, if that's what mom wants to do, that's what she should be able to do.
Industries benefit so largely by a woman giving up and not breastfeeding and going to formula. So many marketing industries and formula industries benefit from a woman giving up. That's why the Fed is Best slogan was created. And I want to point out that this becomes such like a personal story. So like to depersonalize it, it's just like, imagine you had a goal in life, a career goal. And you're going towards this career goal that you really desire. You really want this goal. You want to achieve this career goal. And you hit a hiccup. What if everyone in your corner was just like, that's okay, give up. Stop. Stop going towards your goal because you have this hiccup. Just stop. Imagine that. That's not support. And then imagine you gave up with one hiccup. No, on the way to a career goal, there are going to be many, many failures, many hiccups. And it's often the tenacity through it that creates our confidence, creates our self-esteem, that I just went through this hard thing and I persevered and I'm here for it. And that's how we gain confidence.
I think confidence, and it's like empowering to know that you persevered through, you know, trials and tribulations and hard times and you got out on the other side and you achieved your goal. It's, you know, and it's okay to have a big head about it. Yeah, like people say, oh, you don't get a trophy for having a natural birth. No, but I did get that 2-week-long oxytocin high that I rode out for super long. Like, yeah, I'm going to be really proud of doing that because in a society that tells us that, you know, we can't do things, especially as women, like, oh, you can't do this because you're a woman, or, oh, you know, your body's not made for that, or, you know, just kind of like viewed differently than men are. Like, yeah, I'm going to ride every positive experience that I've had that is empowering for me and makes me feel proud of myself. And, you know, just because somebody else chose another path for themselves doesn't mean that I can't be proud of the things that I've accomplished or the things that I've experienced. And I feel like once we stop diminishing other people's stories and comparing ourselves to them, that we could be more powerful as women. And I'm not going to go really into like my views on modern day feminism. But, you know, I think that empowering women for what we are is a lot different than how society portrays how we're supposed to support other women.
Do you want to just end with maybe like a nugget of encouragement?
If there was anything that I could say about my personal experiences that would help another woman out, it would be to never stop questioning things, never stop looking into anything that, you know, you want for yourself, to always continue growing. And in order to continue growing, you need to keep questioning. It's kind of like real science. Like science is ever changing. And if you don't continue to question things in your own personal life, like you're never going to have that self-growth. Whether it's, you know, what kind of food you eat at the grocery store, or, oh, I'm pregnant and I want these strollers or car seats for my baby. Like, if you don't put in the work to learn, then you are not going to get a good result. And you're never alone. There is always somebody out there who has gone through what you're going through. Don't allow yourself to compare who you are to other people. There are people who have had it worse. There are people who have it significantly better. But that doesn't mean that your feelings and your struggles and your positive experiences are invalid. Like, celebrate yourself and be proud of the things that you've gone through and the person that you are, because at the end of the day, those are the things that make you you.